If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Monday, April the 13th, and welcome back to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to America's 45th president. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Institution Research Fellow and the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. My guest today, joining me via Skype from the other side of the country in the nation's capital, Tebby Troy. Tebby Troy is a best-selling presidential historian and a former senior government official. His latest book, Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump, came out in February and is available for your reading. I suggest you get it to help get you through these in-house times. Tebby, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I worry about the country and I worry about the world, but I am personally fine and my wife and children are healthy, thank God.
That's good to hear, but I do worry about you, my friend, in at least one regard. You and I share something in common besides an interest in politics in Washington. You and I are both baseball fans, if not fanatics, and I feel bad for you in this regard. You're a Washington Nationals fan. To be a Washington Nationals fan is to be a long-suffering Washington Nationals fan because it's a rich tradition of underachievement, and then last year the improbable happens, and they win the World Series. But Tebby, you've been denied the one thing all baseball fans relish, the opportunity to see their team hoist their World Series flag.
Well, it is true. I do like the Nationals, but I am a Yankees fan. It's my top team, so I want to make sure that's clear. But on the Nationals, I did go to a Washington Capitals game long before coronavirus ended all the fun, and the Nationals were there, and they went around on the Zamboni, and they hoisted the trophy there, and that was pretty darn cool.
That was very cool. I wish you had not said you're a Yankees fan. Probably half the podcast just tuned in. The other half probably likes you even more now. The other half probably hates you. So,
I think the worst is when somebody pretends they're a fan of something they're not. You know, the old Hillary Clinton problem where she switched hats. So anybody who knows that I'm a Yankees fan and would hear somebody say that I'm not would be offended.
We're not going to make this podcast all about baseball, but one final note. I find that watching the MLB channel sometimes is a nice escape when they show old games. A couple weeks ago, Tebby, they were showing a Cubs game from back in the 90s, and it was Dwight Gooden was pitching for the Mets, and it was just a lot of fun to watch. It was a windy day at Wrigley. I don't know why MLB landed on this particular game, though, but it was the game where Hillary Clinton comes to Wrigley Field, and she's wearing a Cubs hat and just immediately, you just have the flashback of the Cubs and the Yankees and just reminds you of all the various complicated reasons why people like or don't like Hillary Clinton. Just why, guys, did you show something that had political overtones?
Right. And then Obama, also a Chicago guy, claimed that he said he was a White Sox fan, but that he couldn't name his favorite player. So I just like inauthenticity when it comes to sports fan more than anything else.
I agree with you. So let's talk about the book, which really is a great read. Well done, my friend. The title, very clever, Fight House, which obviously rhymes with White House, but I noticed you did not go with Fight Club. Perhaps for copyright reasons, because it's a movie from the 90s starring Brad Pitt, but maybe also for this reason, Tebby, what's the quote from Fight Club everybody recites? Gentlemen, welcome to Fight Club, the first rule of Fight Club. You do not talk about Fight Club. Tebby, why do people not talk about Fight Club, but why do people in the Fight House talk about the Fight House? In other words, why do people who work for the president leak?
It's a great question, and you are indeed correct that leaking is one of the number one tactics, not the only tactic I detail in Fight House, but one of the top tactics that people use against each other. And people leak for a number of reasons. One is to make themselves look good. Number two is to make their enemies look bad. And number three, and this is important and something I really talk about in Fight House, is if the policy process in the White House is not working, people leak to promote their policy ideas and to get their ideas out there. And so one of the suggestions I have in Fight House for a president being able to limit infighting, you'll never get rid of it, but a way to limit it, is to have a strong policy process where people get to have their views heard around the policy table. And even if they lose, the fact that their voice was heard makes them less likely to leak.
What about Tebby having White House aides sign NDAs, non-disclosure agreements?
Yeah, that is a new thing. I don't know how legally binding they are. I was never asked to sign an NDA when I worked in the Bush White House. However, I did have top secret clearance, actually maybe a little higher. I can't talk about the level, but I had a level of security clearance that forbade me from talking about certain things I learned that were in classified settings. So that is kind of a form of an NDA, but it's different than the NDA that we're seeing recently. And maybe that will be a thing going forward. but I just don't know how enforceable it is. And when people leak anonymously, it's very hard to call them on violating their NDAs.
Tevye, when we talk about White House, we're talking about the White House and a very large staff. Can you ballpark just how many people work for the president, both in the mansion, but also next door in the Eisenhower building?
Yeah, there are about 1,800 people who work for what's known as the Executive Office of the President. It does indeed include the West Wing, it includes the East Wing, it includes the Eisenhower building, as you correctly note. But it also includes the NEOB, the new Executive Office building, which is a kind of red brick monstrosity that's across the street and outside the gates. And it includes the people at Jackson Place. So it includes a little more than just those two buildings. Those two buildings, I would say, are the bulk of them. We're talking about 1,800 people, a lot of whom are career officials, meaning they work for the Obama administration, they work for the Bush administration, they work for the Trump administration. They're there administration in, administration out. And they work at the U.S. Trade Representative's office. They work at the Office of Management and Budget. They work at the Drug Czar's office. So that's about 1,800 people. When I was at the White House, I estimated that the people who are actual political appointees working in the White House operation is somewhere in the 300 to 400 range. Mm-hmm. So those are people you think about on the show West Wing. But the people who might, whose faces might show up on TV, whose names might show up in the newspaper, are really the assistants to the president, which are the top level aides, including the chief of staff and the senior advisor and the head of the National Security Council, and then to some degree the deputy assistants to the president. And I would say that is more on the 30 to 50 range. So 30 to 50 aides who might fit that category depending on the administration.
Right. So there's obviously a necessity for some people to work in the West Wing to be close to the Oval Office, Tevye, but then there's also ego involved here. Who gets space over there? Who decides who sits where?
Well, the Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations, there's two Deputy Chiefs of Staff in most administrations, one for policy, one for operations. And the one for operations is really the one who's in charge of the office space. But there are a whole bunch of other factors involved. So, for example, a very senior person, let's say a vice president or first lady, can go over the head of the Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations, go straight to the president. Another thing is that there is some continuity involved. The National Security Advisor's Office is pretty much going to be the National Security Advisor's Office no matter which administration you're in, not just for tradition, but also because there are certain security protocols that are put into place with that office. So there are some offices that stay the same, some offices that vary, and the Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations is in charge of that.
Right. And the press also uses this as a metaphor for sort of who's large and who's in charge. In the Trump White House, for example, they were fascinated with where Kellyanne Conway perched. In the Bush 43 administration, they were fascinated with Karen Hughes and Karl Rove. There's obviously a lot of fascination back in the beginning of the Clinton days, because I believe Hillary had an office in the West Wing and First Ladies traditionally are in the East Wing. So we do kind of focus on this real estate issue. Do you think it's really all that important, though, where people sit?
Well, I think it actually does make a difference. The closer you are to the president, it gives you prestige, but also it lets you interact with the president more. So that makes a difference. And I have some stories in White House that are in regard to that. So, for example, in the Kennedy administration, Arthur Schlesinger was one of the most famous aides in the Kennedy White House, but he was somewhat remote in that his office was in the West Wing. I mean, in the East Wing, where the First Lady staff, and I even talk about how the West Wing staffers kind of made fun of him for being an East Wing staffer. And then also, you've had other instances. So, for example, in the Ford administration, which is one of the most contentious White Houses I talk about, there was a guy named Robert Hartman who set up shop immediately after Ford ascended from the vice presidency to the presidency in the ante room outside the Oval Office. And he was able to use that perch to monitor the presidential inbox. And he would take out documents he didn't like and give them to Evans and Novak, the political reporters. And he would take documents he did like and shove them in the inbox to get them through without having to go through the staffing process. And Dick Cheney, who became deputy chief of staff and later chief of staff in that administration, one of his jobs was to get Hartman out of that immediately next to the president's office.
So, Tevye, this is the dichotomy of the situation that fascinates me. You work for the president of the United States, and you work at the leisure of the president of the United States. He can hire you or fire you if he so wants. The idea is you're there and you're fiercely loyal to the man. On the other hand, we're also talking about people who go into those jobs, and they're people with their own agendas, if you will. If you're messing with the president's inbox, you are pursuing your own agenda, not the president. So why this balance between the two? Is it just human nature? Is it something unique about working for the president?
Yeah, well, to be fair, Hartman, who I'm quite critical of in my book, In Fight House, Hartman did say that when he went to Evans and Novak, he usually told Ford what he was telling them. So sometimes there's authorized leaks and sometimes there's unauthorized leaks.
Right.
But you're right in the basic premise of your question, which is that you have people who come, especially these days, with independent egos, independent relationships with reporters, independent reputations, and they want to use their time in the White House to advance their own interests as well as the president's interests to some degree. And sometimes those things come into conflict.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems to me that if you go back and maybe to the Reagan presidency or maybe even before that, but you had this process where people worked for the president and they left the presidency and usually they wrote an obligatory book, which is nobody, you know, if only they listened to me, I was right and everybody was wrong. And oftentimes, Tebby, as you well know, these are disgruntled cabinet secretaries who just felt left out and just want to get in the last word. But it seems to me, Tebby, that we're in a different environment now in which aides to the president are doing this in real time. If you watch what's going on in D.C. right now, with people who work for the president and now making very clear that they warned him about coronavirus. They didn't listen to me. I was right about this. Again, I'm just struck by the dichotomy of this. You're working for the president, yet at the same time, you're in the business of trying to save your own hide.
Yeah, well, I would say, Bill, that it's not just a switch that turned on, but something that's developing over time, that's been developing over time. In the Roosevelt administration, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration, you had something called the Brownlow Commission. The Brownlow Commission determined that the president needed help. And that was a famous four-word conclusion. The president needs help. And it called for a series of administrative assistants to the president with a, quote, passion for anonymity. So the whole idea of White House aides came out of that. There was no real White House staff to speak of before the Roosevelt administration, before the Brownlow Commission. And so you initially did have some of these White House aides who did have a passion for anonymity. And it would be hard to name too many White House aides from, let's say, the Truman and Eisenhower years. You and I are political junkies. We can name a couple, like Clark Clifford, for example.
Right.
For the most part, you can't name that many because they did have that passion for anonymity. They were kept out of the press to a large degree. However, over time, and I say it was really the Kennedy administration where you started to have this shift, you had the rise of the celebrity aide. And once you have the rise of a celebrity aide, they, again, as I said earlier, have their independent reputations and their independent relationships with journalists. And those people are much more likely to be out there to be protecting their own reputations in real time, as you suggest. And the other thing is, there's so many more mechanisms for doing so. Right. If you look at a reporter's Twitter feed these days, it's always saying DM me or signal me, or they're trying to find ways that aides can reach them and give them secret information that they shouldn't be giving out without getting caught, because there's a bit of a cat and mouse game between the leakers and the people who are seeking to plug the leaks. That's been a problem in every administration, at least dating back to the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, as I detail in the White House.
Right. So, Tevi, I grew up in Washington. My first job in life, to the extent it was a job, was delivering the Washington Post as a newspaper boy. And I read the newspaper from a young age. And I remember reading about this fellow named Henry Kissinger and all the attention Henry Kissinger thought and got as this, you know, rather intelligent man who would also be, you know, involved with Jill St. John. He became a rock star. Then I remember in the Carter administration, Hamilton Jordan, the chief of staff, and the various antics he got into. I think he made an awkward comment about the Egyptian ambassador's wife, something to do with the pyramids, if I recall.
Yeah, it's true.
And this trend goes forward. But, you know, I think one reason why this might be a problem, Tebby, is the connection between working in an administration and journalism in this regard. Exposure to journalists, relationships with journalists pays off how? If you get along well with a journalist as a leaker, there might be a job waiting for you in punditry. That in turn turns to speaking. It becomes a very lucrative gig. So maybe this is part of the problem here, that just it's too easy to monetize these jobs.
Yeah, well, there's three ways in which the relationship with journalists help. Number one is before you get a job. If a journalist are talking about you and quoting you, then your name is out there and you're more likely to be picked for the job to begin with.
Yes.
The second is while you're there, you could be telling your side of the story. And Colin Powell in the Bush administration was famous for this, because Don Rumsfeld would complain that he would sit in meetings with Powell all day and Powell never disagreed with anything he said in the meeting. But then you'd read in the Washington Post all day long that Powell disagrees with Rumsfeld, and Powell and Rumsfeld are fighting. And so while the administration is going on, it is something. And then, as you correctly note, it does help build you up and set you up for lucrative jobs after administration, even if not in punditry. Maybe you can get a bigger book contract because you have a bigger name. Maybe you can get larger speaking fees. Maybe a corporation wants to hire you. So having a reputation that develops out of your time at the White House can be an immensely valuable commodity.
Somebody who comes to mind, Tebby, and again, I'm aging myself here, is Richard Darman, who is on your list, and I'm going to get to your list in a minute, of the great rivalries in the White House. I worked on the ill-fated Bush 92 campaign, the one that lost, and Dick Darman was very frustrated with the Bush presidency on many grounds, and for some reason, he saw a need to talk to the Washington Post about the failures of the administration, and this was live in time while the administration is still alive, and I remember reading it and thinking, my gosh, could there be kind of a greater act of heresy and treason, really, to go to the Post and just crap all over everybody you work with.
Yeah, especially in the Bush 41 administration, where it was really seen as inappropriate and improper to be talking to the press. So it was a cardinal sin in that administration. But you're right, Darman was a master leaker, was known for talking to the press, and he had enemies who recognized that. And there was even a great story that I talk about in Fight House, that Darman's enemies used to leak to the press using big words, because Darman had this big vocabulary and liked showing it off. So they would use big words like inchoate. And so people would think that only Darman would use the word inchoate in talking to a Washington Post reporter, and then it would presumably get blamed on Darman.
That is very clever. So you talked about this larger operation, this 1,800 personnel plus, but a smaller percentage that are actual appointees of the president. We always wanted to trace back to modern presidencies. A lot of people had to go back to Roosevelt using radio, sort of modern broadcasting, if you will. But if you're going to date back the beginnings of the Fight House, how far back would you go? Is this a 20th century phenomenon? Could you go back deeper into history to the 18th century? How back would you go, Tebby?
Well, look, there's this hit musical Hamilton that talks about fighting in the Washington administration. But those fights, I note in the book, are among cabinet secretaries. Right. And so what I'm really trying to get at in Fight House are rivalries that have to do with the White House staff. Sometimes it can be a cabinet secretary and a White House staff member. But I argue that the White House staff, which developed, as I said, under Roosevelt, but the first president to enter with a White House staff was Truman. And so once you had that development of a White House staff, it changed the dynamic of how cabinet secretaries dealt with the president. It changed the dynamic of who was getting the word out about various things. It changed the dynamic of who had information. And so what I'm really looking at Fight House is the period from Truman on, and it even says that in the title, from Truman to Trump, but the period from Truman on where you had a White House staff and how the White House staff changed and in many ways exacerbated internal tensions in administrations.
Right. So we don't have baseball, Tebby. We also have not had the NCAA basketball tournament. I'm going to read to you now. It's not the Sweet 16, but let's call it the Dirty Dozen. And these are 12 rivalries that you pick out in your book from Truman to Obama, 12 presidencies. I'm going to read them back to you, Tebby, and then I'd like you to pick out one or two, because I have one or two I'm interested in as well. So here are the Dirty Dozen, folks. The Truman administration, it's George Marshall versus Clark Clifford. The Eisenhower administration is John Foster Dulles versus Harold Stassen. The Kennedy administration is Lyndon Johnson versus Robert Kennedy. That's a heavyweight battle. The Johnson administration, Robert McNamara versus George Ball. The Nixon administration, Henry Kissinger versus William Rogers. I'm seeing a lot of foreign policy here, Tebby. The Ford administration, as you mentioned, Robert Hartman versus Al Haig and Donald Rumsfeld. The Carter administration, Cy Vance versus Zbigniew Brzezinski, again, a heavyweight duel. The Reagan administration, Michael Deaver versus Haig again. Al Haig makes two appearances on the list, and Ed Meese. The Bush 41 administration, Dick Darman, who we talked about, versus, as you say, nearly everyone. The Clinton administration, Dick Morris versus Harold Ickes. The Bush 43 administration, Don Rumsfeld, who you mentioned, versus Colin Powell and Richard Armitage. And finally, the Obama administration, Valerie Jarrett versus Rahm Emanuel. Tebby, pick and choose who you'd like to talk about there.
Well, first, let me note that you correctly point out there's a theme of foreign policy rivalries. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one is when you have the development of a national security advisor, that person is next to the president and advising the president and thinks of themselves as the chief foreign policy strategist slash operative slash advisor.
So that's what gets you Vance versus Brzezinski, for example, right?
Right. Or Kissinger versus Rogers.
Right.
And to some extent, the one in the Truman administration you mentioned with Clark Clifford versus George Marshall, that was a great one where Clifford was a relatively junior aide. He became much famous later and became the Secretary of Defense later. But right. he was advising Truman on the recognition of the State of Israel. And Marshall was adamantly opposed to recognizing Israel, which seems bizarre to us today. But at the time, that's where the rest of the foreign policy establishment was.
Go ahead.
And just quickly, that Marshall was mortified that this domestic policy advisor, Clifer, was arguing in favor of recognizing Israel and didn't think he had any place in this conversation. But Clifford wins the argument in front of Truman, and Marshall is so mad that he never again spoke to Clifford or uttered his name for the rest of his life.
Right. Tevi, walk me through Lyndon Johnson versus Robert Kennedy. This fascinates me on two levels. Number one, these are real heavyweights. Lyndon Johnson was a very powerful man before becoming vice president. You could argue way less powerful because he ran the Senate before that. Robert Kennedy is the brother of the president, who sits in the Justice Department as the AG, basically to have his brother's back. And these two people just, you can maybe write off some of these as professional rivalries, but these two people hate each other. And I underscore the word hate. It is just a hate, rarely the likes of what you see in a White House. Describe that relationship.
It's a great rivalry. And there's even a quote that I have in Fight House from Joseph Kennedy, who was the father of Robert F. Kennedy, and he said, "Bobby's my boy. When he hates you, you stay hated." And Lyndon Johnson really stayed hated. And look, they met each other in the 1950s when both were in working in the Senate. Johnson, obviously, is Senate Majority Leader, and Kennedy is a relatively lowly staffer. And they disliked each other from the first interaction, when Kennedy refuses to stand up and shake Johnson's hand, and Johnson hovers over him and glowers at him until Kennedy finally relents and reluctantly shakes the hand. And it never got better from that very low moment. And then the shifting power dynamic is something that I find really fascinating, because when Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, is president, RFK is the most senior and most important person in the administration next to his brother, the president. Right. And he tries to humiliate Johnson, and he leaves Johnson out, and Johnson is completely marginalized and indeed miserable as he was in his entire life, was in that period when he was vice president. But then in the blink of an eye, there's the tragic assassination in Dallas, and suddenly John F. Kennedy is no longer president. Robert F. Kennedy is still attorney general, but serving under a president who hates him. And I even tell the story in Fight House of how there's the first cabinet meeting in the Johnson presidency. Kennedy comes late to it. Johnson thinks that Kennedy is showing him up, and they kind of have it out in the Oval Office. And then Kennedy and Johnson don't speak for 2 months after that point, which is astonishing, given that Kennedy is the sitting attorney general in that administration. And then Kennedy's status as a senator in the second term of the Johnson administration, or after Johnson's election and defeat of Goldwater in 64, mm-hmm. Kennedy really torments Johnson over the Vietnam issue. And I argue in the book that Johnson, many of his positions were taken in response to what he thought Kennedy would be doing. He felt that if he drifted at all away towards the militarist position in Vietnam, that Kennedy would be all over him and flanking him from the right. But indeed, what it was going on was Kennedy was flanking him from the left, and it was driving Johnson crazy.
Right. Plus, you point out the rivalry in the Johnson administration is Robert McNamara versus George Ball. You know, this is a carryover in Kennedy. This is the best and the brightest.
Yeah, and the best and the brightest, I would argue, and I do argue, don't serve the country well, because Johnson could not stand fighting underneath him, and he wanted to make sure everybody was on the same page. And right. the only person who was allowed to question or quibble about the Vietnam policy at all was indeed George Ball, as you note. But it was with the dispensation of Johnson and the other aides, Ball notes, did not necessarily view him favorably because of his position. And there was even a group of folks in the State Department who were concerned about the direction of Vietnam policy. And they were so scared that Johnson would find out that they called themselves the non-group, and they had secret meetings so that Johnson would be able to find out that this group existed.
Tevi, has there ever been a situation where a president of the United States has looked at a situation like this and said, enough fighting, and as he called the principals in the Oval Office and either told them to get along or dress them down? In other words, has the president ever gotten personally involved in these feuds, or do presidents just sit back and either let it ride or let the chief of staff deal with it?
Well, it's an open question in Fight House, and there are different presidents who take different approaches. Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan kind of had this, well, you fellas work it out approach, which I argue worked pretty well, because even though there was fighting in the administration, the Reagan administration, it was a pretty successful administration, and they got a lot done. In the Obama administration, Obama was pretty clear that he did not want people fighting, and he had this whole no-drama Obama idea, and he would chide people if they sent overly contentious emails, as I detail in the book. That doesn't mean there was no fighting in the Obama administration, and I detail plenty of it. But the president was involved to the extent that he was saying, I don't want to see this stuff happen. And Gerry Ford tried to tell his people to knock it off, but it was somewhat ineffectual. So, yeah, you see different presidents taking different approaches to it. I don't think a president just yelling at the staff saying stop fighting is really going to work. You need processes in place to limit it.
You also, Tebby, had in the Reagan administration a first lady who was involved in personnel and taking notes and noticing who was serving her husband well. You could have easily made the fight Nancy Reagan versus Donald Regan.
Yeah, Donald, and that is something I detail in Fight House. And there's a couple of great stories there. One is that Nancy Reagan really did not think, Nancy Reagan did not think Don Regan was up to the task.
Right.
And she said that he was the chief of staff, and she said he's pretty good at the chief part, but he doesn't get the of staff part. Mm-hmm. And then later they have a fight where Regan, in frustration, hangs up on the first lady. And Jim Baker, who was the first chief of staff in that administration, said, that's not just a firing offense, that's a hanging offense.
Mm-hmm. And also, you also notice the fight in the Reagan administration is Deaver versus Hagen. Meese. Deaver famously has a very close relationship with the first lady. Is there a history, Tebby, of AIDS sidling up to the first lady, getting on her good side to, in effect, you know, have a buffer?
There are definitely instances of that. So Valerie Jarrett in the Obama administration was very close to the first lady and would use that first lady link to get people to go along with what she was saying. And there were sometimes some people were skeptical of it, like Robert Gibbs, the press secretary, didn't really believe she was talking to the first lady as much as she said she was, or maybe she was talking to her, but she wasn't necessarily accurately conveying what the first lady was saying. So that is occasionally an issue. The first lady does get involved in some of these fights, as you said. In the Reagan administration, she clearly had it in for Don Regan, and she was favorably disposed towards Mike Deaver. So yeah, the first lady does occasionally get involved in this stuff.
Yeah. Explain the Valerie Jarrett, Rahm Emanuel dynamic a little bit, because I think, Tebby, there are two issues here. Number one, Valerie Jarrett was a minister without a portfolio. Just this ability, as I remember, just to drop into pretty much any meeting she wanted to, which can be a very dangerous thing in West Wing operations. Just means you're just overextended and just really a little too nosy, maybe. But I suspect the other issue was that she had access to the first couple as friends dating back to Chicago, and she could go up to the residence at night and push whatever she wanted to push and complain about whoever she wanted to complain about. Was that at the heart of the issue between her and the chief of staff?
Oh, yeah, I think that was a key part of it. And you mentioned that she would go see the Obamas at night and get her perspective heard in these policy debates. And for that reason, her internal nickname was the Night Stalker. But I think the weird dynamic in the Obama administration was that Valerie Jarrett was the most powerful aide, but she wasn't the chief of staff.
Right.
And if you look at the first Obama term, he goes through four chiefs of staff, one kind of temporary one, but three full-time ones, and none of them really get along so well with Jarrett, the first two, especially Rahm Emanuel, leaves after a year to go to Chicago, and then Bill Daley is the second chief of staff, disliked her so much that supposedly he couldn't even be in the same room with her.
Right.
So you had that dynamic in the first term, and then in the second term, they finally figured out how to find a chief of staff who recognized that he was kind of beneath her in the org chart in a way, and there was Dennis McDonough, and kind of let her have free reign, and he was able to survive all 4 years.
And she goes wire to wire with the Obamas, does she not? Because I want to lead you now into a talk about turnover, but she was there at the beginning, and she went all 8 years, did she not?
She was there. It is pretty rare for a White House aide to stay all 8 years, but mm-hmm. she did it, and she was close to the Obamas, and she knew I think she was independently okay, if not fully wealthy. And she also, she knew she'd have opportunities after. So sometimes some people don't want to turn off the lights. They want to take care of opportunities first. Some people feel like if you can survive a certain number of years without having an investigation or legal trouble, you may want to quit while getting as good. So there's all kinds of reasons why people don't stay a full administration. But Valerie Jarrett was so close to the Obamas, and she did stay all 8 years.
There are many schools of thought on how long to stay in administration, Tebby. The late Marty Anderson, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, who was in the very early stages of the Reagan White House. He went back to Reagan in 76. That's how old school Reagan he was. Marty said that if you're going to work in a White House, you work there in year one, because that's when the stuff's going to happen. That's when everything is fresh. And after year one, you decide how long you want to stay. But he was pretty much a one-year advocate. I'm looking at a Brookings Institute study of White House personnel, Tebby, and they track what they call the A-team of the executive office. This does not include cabinet secretaries, but it's the higher echelon of appointees. Here are the numbers they show for turnover right now. They went back to Reagan. They claim Reagan at this point had a 78% turnover in staff. Bush 41 had a 66% turnover. Clinton a 74% turnover. Bush 43 a 63% turnover. Obama a 71% turnover. And now hold on, Donald Trump's turnover rate is 85%. You look at those and compared to the private sector, those are pretty jarring numbers.
Yeah, but not hugely surprising. And it is interesting that the four administrations you mentioned before the current one are all in the 60 and 70 range. So not a huge variation. Again, it's a pretty small denominator also. So it's not shocking to have relatively large numbers. People do get exhausted. The joke is that in Republican administrations, folks who join the administration are taking a pay cut, so they don't want to stay as long. And then in Democratic administrations, if you're coming from, let's say, academia or a labor union or a public interest group, you're often getting a pay hike. So sometimes that has an impact on whether you're staying longer or shorter. Sometimes the national emergencies make you stay longer. So I think there are people in the Bush 43 administration who probably stayed longer than they thought they were going to because of 9/11. Right. So those are all factors. But the truth is, these are exhausting jobs. When I worked in the Bush White House, I did not see my family from Sunday night till Friday night. Not some weeks, every week. And it's exhausting hours. I don't regret it. And I learned a ton, and I felt like I was able to serve the country. And it's an amazing opportunity that people should take advantage of if they can. But it is exhausting. You're not making a lot of money. It's fraught with legal peril. You make a mistake and it shows up in the newspapers. You can have investigations. So there's reasons why people don't want to do it forever. But short term, it is really an amazing opportunity to serve your country.
I remember, Tebby, NBC News used to do this primetime special called A Day at the White House. And this was very carefully staged. The White House would pick out the day for NBC to come film. And of course, all kinds of West Wing fascinating stuff would be going on. Everybody was on top of their game and everybody looked great and sounded great and all that. But you would watch it. And I remember watching the one for Bush 43. And I remember how they chronicled Andy Card as chief of staff, who was a chief of staff for a long time, by the way, like what, 4 or 5 years, a very long time. But they just showed this day beginning before dawn and ending late into the night. And I remember thinking, this is really fascinating. But my God, what happens when there's a crisis? People are going to be sleep deprived and exhausted.
Yeah.
So it does make for an argument for turnover and forced vacations and just kind of getting people out of the building.
Yeah, there's a Disraeli, I guess Blake's biography of Disraeli talked about Gladstone's cabinet. So this 19th century England as a series of exhausted volcanoes after too long in the administration. And Nixon actually looked at that line, the exhausted volcanoes line, and used it to ask his entire cabinet to resign at the end of the first term. He didn't accept everyone's resignation, but it was very influential in his thinking. So yeah, these people do get exhausted. I remember a friend of mine who went to have lunch at the White House mess in the Clinton administration. I said, what was it like? I'd never been to the White House mess at that point. And he said, it looks like high school during finals week. Everybody's got bags under their eyes. They've got poor skin. They look exhausted. They're a little overweight because they're not eating well. Right. And it is not an easy duty. Now, I recognize right now during the coronavirus crisis, I mean, people are going through real life trauma. And then obviously we've had soldiers at war for almost 20 years with the war on terror. So, there are worse and more dangerous postings, obviously, but it is an exhausting period.
But, Tebby, when you mentioned the Clinton administration, that's also a function of the man himself, because Clinton famously did not like to be alone, which led him into an impeachable problem down the road. But he liked to have staffers around at all hours, and he liked to talk policy and have a lot of just long jab sessions and play hearts. In other words, he thrived on it. And so this is an interesting question. If you've gone back and looked at these administrations, how much is the staff a reflection of the man himself in terms of how they operate?
Oh, I think it's hugely a reflection. Lyndon Johnson really wanted his staff there at all hours. Lyndon Johnson would get up early in the morning. He'd go to the White House before 7, and he would work all day until 2 or so, and he would take a nap, have a snack, and take a walk. And he expected his staff to keep working in that period. And then after he was rejuvenated from the nap, snack, and walk, he would then work till late into the night, expecting his staff to have worked from early in the morning till late at night. And Johnson checked up on you. He would call people's phones to make sure they're there. And this is before the days of voicemail or cell phone. So if you didn't answer your phone, that meant you weren't at your desk and you weren't where you were supposed to be. And Johnson would call you on it.
And how many people have you worked for, Tevi, who would call you into their bathroom while they're doing their business?
I've never worked for anyone who did that. I do know Johnson famously did it. I do know of another story that I'm not going to say on the air about a president who kind of made fun of people for if they went in and if they didn't go in. So it can be an issue when you're spending this much time with somebody. But for the most part, Johnson was unique in his bathroom approach.
I'm also curious, as you look at the Kennedy administration, there's a certain kind of anything goes ethos, which is a reflection on the man himself. And the stories continue to pour out about Jack Kennedy and dalliances with White House aides and swimming naked in the pool and things like that. Has there ever been a culture like Kennedy's, or is that just a one-off?
Well, they say that Lyndon Johnson was also having a variety of affairs mm-hmm. in the White House, but you really had a shift in the media somewhere as a result of Vietnam and as a result of Watergate, that the media said, you know, we're not going to let these people skate by anymore. If there's any malfeasance in the White House at all, even if it's minor, we're going to report on it. And so after that, you really had to have people behave differently, and you just couldn't have the anything goes ethos of the Kennedy administration to the same degree after that.
All right. 45 is in the title of this podcast, Tevi. So let's talk about 45's administration for a minute. You have not figured out the rivalry here yet. I guess you're going to wait really until either later on or the administration's over. But let me throw an idea of a rivalry at you. And that's not one person against one person, but maybe it's the trio of the president, his daughter, and his son-in-law versus the world.
Yeah, I mean, there's some...
Or at least I should say versus Washington.
Look, there's some evidence of that, and maybe it's not just the three of them, but, you know, Peter Navarro also, I guess, maybe is in that category. And you had Steve Bannon in the early days of the administration. One of the reasons I really don't get into this in the book in Fight House is because you can't really know at this point. Right. I tried to make Fight House as relevant and not dated as possible, but I note that there were three chiefs of staff in the Trump administration. Well, now there's a fourth. And again, this stuff changes so often. And if you wrote it just when the Reince Priebus chief of staff period had been, he would have ignored the Kelly attempts to impose some order, and then the way that Mulvaney came in and took a different approach. So you really want to wait until after administration's over to give a full assessment of what's going on. Then you also start to have access to the oral history archives, which only came online for the Bush 43 administration in 2019, 10 years after the administration ended. Sometimes you get memoirs that are a little more forthcoming when an administration ends. So I'm really looking forward to opening it up after the Trump administration ends and finding out what actually happened as opposed to some of the press reports of what's happening.
Right, but you do see a turnover in very high-profile positions. He's blazing through chiefs of staff and press secretaries and national security advisors. Is there any historical parallel to previous presidencies?
The early days of the Clinton administration was quite tumultuous, and there was some turnover there and some people who didn't make it through the process to begin with because of vetting issues. Mm-hmm. But Clinton did right the ship a little bit. I think obviously there's some internal factors going on here, but I think there's also some external factors. I mean, the idea that we want to investigate everybody for everything it takes a toll on people. And it takes a toll on people mentally, but also takes a toll on people's finances. I remember somebody in the Bush 43 administration, who was a friend of mine, who was being investigated. Everything was fine. She didn't do anything wrong, but she had to hire a lawyer. And a friend of hers who'd worked in the administration, worked at a well-known law firm, an expensive law firm, and offered her a friend discount. And the White House counsel's office, the ethics officer, said, you can't do that because you can't get any consideration as someone who works in the White House. You can't get any financial benefit from it.
Right.
So she was in this position where she had to pay out of pocket for a lawyer who was willing to give her a break, and she had to pay top dollar for that lawyer.
That sounds bad. Question for you, my friend. You look at the system as it is right now. You look at the Fight House Are you okay with the way things are? Do you think changes need to be made? If you want to make changes, what changes would you make?
Yeah, I do think that ministers without a portfolio are a problem, like you suggested with Valerie Jarrett. I think they often lead to challenging situations. But I also lay out in Fight House the three levers that a president has if they want to reduce fighting in the administration. And one is to limit ideological disagreement. You hire people who are on the same team ideologically, you'll get less fighting. You may also get less information and less of a free and open back and forth, but that, you know, it's a trade-off. The second thing is, if you have a clear and tight process, you're going to have people less likely to be leaking to the press about it, and you have a clear lines of authority, and you're going to have fewer problems in that regard. And the third is a president who's willing to say, I don't want to see this kind of stuff, and tell people that they are expected to act in a certain way, and then you'll also see less of it. And again, these don't eliminate fighting in the White House, but they can manage it. Because what I argue in Fight House is that we have a continuum. If there's absolute chaos, nobody trusts one another, everybody's leaking to the press, and nobody can have internal meetings without fearing that it's going to negatively impact on them either publicly or privately, then you can't really have free and open decisions. But, however, if you're too tied, you're too buttoned down, you're too tight, then you have a situation where you don't have open discussions and you don't listen to outside voices and you are going to make bad decisions. So you've got to find the right thing. And this gets back to your question, Bill, about the personality of the president. A president has to find the right spot on the continuum that works for him or her. And you're not going to be able to have an administration that works unless you find that sweet spot.
A couple minutes now on Joe Biden. Let's suppose a year from now, Joe Biden is the president of the United States. This is interesting, at least in this regard, Tebby. This is a man who had come to office. Joe Biden first came to Washington, let's see, January of 1973, I believe. So he would be taking office with almost 50 years of Washington relations under his belt, two presidential campaigns, a long time on the national stage. This will make for a very complicated personnel situation, Tebby, because what? There are going to be people who've known Joe Biden going back 50 years, people who have known him since the 80s when he became a Judiciary Committee chairman, when he ran for president, people who knew him in the 90s, people who knew him for the Obama years, people who worked on his campaign. How is Joe Biden going to process that and have a functional White House?
Well, it's a really good question, and we've already seen some indications that there are problems. I mean, I was thinking when it looked like Biden was going to get knocked out of the race, that there was a possible narrative that Biden really never had a message. He still doesn't really have a message other than he's not the current president. But the lack of message, according to a Washington Post article, resulted from infighting in the campaign of Biden, right. That led to them being unable to agree on a message, which led to Biden kind of floundering through the early primaries. And there was only once pretty much everybody had dropped out, and it was him against Bernie, and everyone was worried about how a socialist candidate would fare, that the Democratic Party kind of coalesced around Biden, not, again, because of his message, but because of fear of Bernie and what might happen in the next election. And so there's already some indications that there's dysfunction and infighting, and they've had a couple of staff turnovers. Again, I don't want to get too far out there and speculating, because we don't know the real story yet, and hopefully we'll find it down the road, as we do with all of these situations. But to suggest that there's no fighting in Biden world already, I think would be naive and not following what's actually going on.
I find it very interesting, what if, Tevi, because he's been in a White House that had to staff, so he knows how to staff. But if you compare it, say, to the Clinton administration, you know, Clinton had a problem when he came in, and that was finding available Democratic talent there. Democrats with the most presidential talent in Washington went back to the Carter years. He and Jimmy Carter had a rotten relationship, so did not want to be dependent upon Carter people. But Biden, in addition to his own world, can tap into the Obama world. There are just going to be all these different concentric circles that he's going to have to juggle in terms of he's going to decide who's going to be around him.
Yeah, on the Clinton front, there were also 12 years between the right. Carter administration. So a lot of those people had gotten stale. And also there was a sense that the Carter administration was a failure, so they didn't want to hire too many people from that administration.
Exactly.
So the situation you suggest here is even worse, because the Obama administration is not seen by Democrats as a failure.
Right.
Biden was heavily involved in it. So you're going to have all these people who are just eager to get back in. And so you're going to have Biden people, you're going to have Obama people, and you're going to have the new campaign people, and you know, people who've known for 50 years. It's going to be a bit of a hot mess. And it reminds me of something that Jim Carville once said, which is a campaign is about screwing your enemies, but a transition is about screwing your friends.
What other faction he has to please? The Bernie Bros. So he has to, he's going to have to find a couple of places in his staff or somewhere around the administration where people ties to Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question, because I think those people might end up getting left out given all those other competing factors. And then that could be an issue in the midterm election, or it could be an issue in a potential Biden reelection campaign. So, yeah, I don't know how well the Bernie Bros are going to do, given A, how hostile they were, but B, how reluctant Bernie was to endorse Biden. I saw today that he finally came around and did it. But yeah. I think there's going to be some really interesting questions and some people left by the wayside who are not happy about it.
Okay, but the other scenario is that this is academic because Biden loses the election, in which case Donald Trump is looking at a second term. Tebby, does this happen, actually, the idea that a president is reelected and everybody submits their resignation and the president decides who comes back? Does that really happen, or is that just Hollywood fiction?
It has happened in a number of instances. It does not always happen. So I mentioned the Nixon re-election, that Nixon called for resignations, but he later regretted it. So it's not something I would advise a president to do. Carter asked for the resignation of a lot of his staff after his Camp David speech back in the famous Malay speech in 79 or 80. Mm-hmm. And that kind of hurt him because it was seen as he was a little out of control, and that was problematic for him. So just asking for wholesale resignations is not necessarily a good thing. I'm also reminded of the transition from the Reagan White House to the Bush White House. The Reagan people thought they'd be able to stay, and they were all asked to leave. And there's a famous quote from a transition official in Bush 41 who said, "Our people don't have ideologies, they have mortgages."
Well put. So the final question for Trump, if he is reelected and he looks at a second term, what should he be thinking about staff-wise, Tebby, in terms of who to bring on? Because he has a challenge, and that's that he is a lame duck. And people in Washington, some people will work at a White House at any time to get that diploma on their wall. But some people are hesitant because the presidents in a second term are running out of gas. And so it's hard to necessarily get the cream of the crop.
Now, I think it's a lot easier to get somebody in the first year of a second term than in the fourth year of a first term. So yes. I think it's more challenging now to some degree. I worked in a Senate office once, and someone told me we were running for re-election. They said, if you win, expect a baby boom in your office because you've got six clear years without having to run for re-election. So the fact of a four-year period is kind of an eternity in Washington terms. So I don't think recruiting would be a problem at the beginning of a second term. Towards the end of a second term, it does get more challenging.
Okay. The book, again, is Fight House Rivalries in the White House, From Truman to Trump. Tebby, I hope we get back to normal soon and you can get out on the road and start selling some books.
Amen. Would love that. But thank you for helping me in this way.
Thank you. Great conversation, my friend. You take care.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States, in this case, the White House painted in white. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, get your friends to have a listen, get them to rate us as well. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows in your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. So it's @HooverInst. Tevi Troy is also on Twitter, and his Twitter handle is @TeviTroy. That is spelled TEVITROY, @TeviTroy. His book, as I mentioned, White House, Rivalries in the White House, From Truman to Trump. It's available on Amazon. Go get a copy. It's a great read, and you've got time at home to read right now. You can also find Tevi's astute writing at his website, and that is www.TeviTroy.org. Anything else I need to mention, Tebby?
No, I think we're good.
Okay. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care, stay safe, stay strong, stay healthy, and we'll do our best here at the Hoover Institution to help you stay informed. Take care.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.